This is the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. Gotta be high before I can sway. Lighter tea and let it be. If you a viper.
That is vocalist Aaron McEwen. Larry, who wrote that? Where's this song come from?
That's from the mid-30s, 1936. It was written by Stuff Smith and recorded by his band, the Onyx Boys, but probably best known as a Fats Waller tune to most people.
Jeez, there's not anybody within 100 miles of here who would have known that off the top of their head except you. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. If you live in this area, Humboldt, Mendocino, Trinity, pretty much anywhere in this part of Northern California, as a matter of fact, then you know that marijuana affects you and your community either directly or even indirectly, whether we're talking about the economy or, let's say, local business, crime, law enforcement, state and federal laws, regulations, or just the general local culture. It's here. We know it's here for better or for worse, depending upon your point of view. The Humboldt Chronicles over time is going to address all of these broad issues. But in this hour tonight, we're starting by asking the question, how did we get here in the first place? We're going to be including your phone calls a little bit later. Here's the number for later, 707-786-5946, 786-5946. You can also email questions or comments to studio at 941lounge.com, studio at 941lounge.com. We're also going to be talking with an archaeologist, yes, an archaeologist, who's looked at this question, and a longtime area attorney who's been active in local politics and culture around here as well. First, though, why here? Why this part of this state? What set of circumstances made it happen here? To find out, we're going to go back to San Francisco in the 1960s.
It qualifies as a mass migration. Tens of thousands of kids, mostly 25 and under, heading to San Francisco in the mid to late 1960s, walking away from society's precast molds that they were supposed to pour their lives into, be shaped by, and just accept.
I started in the hippie scene in 64. I was 19. I left home because during my life there were certain incidents that happened that upset this American balance, middle class balance, where everything is just so-so. Graduate from school, go to college, get a job, raise a family, visit the in-laws, you know, a roundabout thing like that. Well, too many things happened to upset that, to show that that wasn't real.
There's no doubt there were plenty of reasons to search for something new. Parental pressure, violence in the streets, the war in Vietnam. It was an unsettled time with change in the air.
The war in Vietnam is not like these other wars. Yet, finally, war is always the same. It is young men dying in the fullness of their promise.
Viceroy for the taste that's right. Right any time of the day.
I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome.
Star Trek, brought to you by Polaroid, makers of the 1967 economy model of the Polaroid Color Pack Camera.
As more and more kids arrived in San Francisco, they became news themselves, with cameras and microphones showing up from all over the world, like the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, who produced a documentary on the San Francisco scene, and even talked with a bus driver shuttling onlookers around Haight-Ashbury.
Well, this is Ashbury Street here. A lot of the street seemed to be a popular street among the hippies. Why, I really couldn't say, because I've never asked any of them. I'd say the most concentration among the hippies is right along between Haight, Masonic, and Ashbury.
There are literally hundreds of these fellas, bearded and girls that are dressed eccentrically, and cars with flowers painted on them, and it's really just out of this world.
It was a new path. A new way of living, evolving in the middle of an existing urban area. A pastoral scene juxtaposed against a larger world seen as chaotic and directionless. New ideas were hatched. New philosophy. New language. New music.
Born right out of the belly of San Francisco, Santana.
Santana at the Fillmore. Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Grateful Dead, all new bands building upon a folk music scene that already existed in the city. It was a whole new world, and hard to understand for the previous generation.
I think they're the disaffiliates, you know, the alienated people in our society. They're dissatisfied with the current values, and they're looking for some of their own, and I think it's worthwhile. You know, I'm surely in sympathy with the anti-war sentiments, you know, that most of them have. Now, the glorification of drugs is something else. I can't get behind that quite so wholeheartedly. That's the voice of experience.
Drugs, as big an ingredient as anything else in the search for a better way. There to see it all was Robert Thoman, now of McKinleyville, but in San Francisco in the 60s after a tour in the military.
Somebody offered me to trade some hash for my Boda bag, which had some really good wine in it, and I was about to trade that for some hash. And my idea of hash was something that you got in a can, and it had meat and potatoes in it, you know? That's all I knew about hash in 1968. I was introduced to marijuana. I enjoyed it. It wasn't a big thing. It was, you know, not a lot different than drinking a beer or smoking a cigarette or something. I mean, it was kind of fun what it did, but it wasn't all that potent at the time. Most of it came from Mexico.
And the kids kept coming. By 1969 and 1970, some estimates top 100,000 of them.
See it. It's overcrowded. It's very, very bad on Hay Street. There's not a good feeling there. Kids are sitting around begging. There's nothing for them to do. It's dirty. The city doesn't clean up anymore.
Issues started cropping up in 68, 69. The Summer of Love was a really unique time in American history, and in San Francisco history, in particular, Bay Area.
That's archaeologist Nick Angeloff, who grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and who has made a study of the 1960s in the Bay Area and the migration northward.
Folks lived a commune type of lifestyle in the middle of the city. That started breaking down. There was starting to be excessive drug use. The impacts of having fun and living free started to occur in an urban environment. So there was a big move in the end to get away from the urban environment and move into a rural environment. Well, started in Sonoma, that wasn't nearly as populated back then, goes up to Mendocino, and then comes up to Humboldt County, even as far as Oregon. But Humboldt County really was the destination location. And initially, it was what I call the counterculture. Counterculture movement, the back-to-landers, the homesteaders. They grouped together in commune type of scenarios, and I started trying to make a living off the land.
There comes a time. You and I, we were captured.
Robert Thoman found his way to Humboldt from the Bay Area in 1970. He's glad he made it here, but he and others like him didn't exactly find a welcoming party waiting.
I moved up here, and the atmosphere was quite different. I mean, if you walked into a bar or a hardware store even, you'd hear a lot of nasty comments made about dirty hippies and skinny dipping at Clam Beach or whatever. There was always some kind of complaints about these people that were moving in. Marijuana was available. You could buy a pound for $100, or you could buy a brick. That was 2.2 pounds. That was a kilo. That was about $200. And you could cut it up into ounces and sell it for $10, and everybody's real happy to get it for $10, and you got to keep some yourself for free.
But at this time, it's not a huge business.
Oh, no, not at all. No, you had to go around and find somebody. Nobody was growing it.
Tell me about the locals and how they received people coming here in the 60s, 70s.
Yeah, the people that worked in the logging industry were not at all friendly towards the people, for the kids especially, the hippie-looking kids, because they threatened their jobs. The lumber companies continued to tell them that the reason they were losing their jobs was because of these kids, even though they were automating, putting people out of jobs by making more automated things, but it was easy to blame it on the hippies. So they were very hostile towards the hippies. It was uncomfortable for a while.
So you did feel some of that?
Oh, yeah, I definitely felt some of it because I had not real long hair, but I had longer hair, and I was obviously not one of them.
Yeah.
So
you felt some us and them kind of thing?
Yeah, a little bit of friction. The thing is, once you got acquainted with them, they were very nice people. And once they realized that you were just a human being like them, that was not a problem. But it's grown a lot. Humboldt County's grown a lot, and that's made it a little bit nicer.
Comes a time.
As things changed, Nick Angeloff points out that some local ranch owners and landowners agreed to sell or lease some of their land to the newcomers.
Isolation, land's cheap. Back then, the logging industry had significant amounts of land that they were basically just giving away at that point. So it was easy to get into land here. Ranchers were amenable to having people come up and buy a plot of land. A very, very rural community. Hard to get to as well. The roads weren't as good as they are today, but they're okay. The logging industry had developed some roads. So it was a unique spot. People could get out of the way. They could go into the backwoods. Some of the most rural places in the United States are in Humboldt County. And they could live a lifestyle that they dreamed of in the summer of love.
So that brings us up to about the early 1970s or so. We're going to get some reaction to that and some insight from two people who know, archaeologist Nick Angeloff and attorney Eric Kirk, in just a couple of minutes. And later, don't forget, we're going to be including you to this panel as well with some of your phone calls and emails. Back in just a minute. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Joining us now in the studio, archaeologist Nick Angeloff and attorney Eric Kirk. Guys, thanks for being here to talk about this. It's a huge topic. Nick, first to you. You're an archaeologist.
Yep.
Here's the thing. I think when most people hear the word archaeologist, the mind's eye pictures some sweaty guy hunched over in the desert with a dental pick, sifting through grains of sand looking for signs of ancient Egypt. It's got to be a long road from there to the hills of Humboldt, so, and maybe not a very crowded path. So talk to me about that. Why is an archaeologist studying this in Humboldt County, California?
Actually, I started here. Humboldt State University has an archaeological program. Jamie Roscoe got me into the business. He told me I could get paid to find arrowheads. I said, "You got to be kidding me." So I ended up working out in the desert, digging the same holes.
So you
was
did
digging
do that
for foundations. Right. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Down south in Southern California, not in Egypt yet.
Yeah.
But ended up going to Sac State to get a graduate degree. And coming back up, establishing myself up here.
Why studying cannabis here?
The archaeological world is now inundated with
surveys for cannabis permits. So initially, one of the applicants asked me to prove that they had had trespass grows on their property. During that project, I documented archaeologically all the archaeological remnants of trespass cannabis grows on a 7,000 acre ranch.
Got it.
During as a part of that, I decided that it might just be interesting to write a history of cannabis for this report, and so I did. And ever since then, each project I go on, I ask a little bit about it and do my use my anthropological background to learn more and more about the history.
And you're right with Archaeological Research and Supply, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And we're going to get to that report that you wrote here in just a second, Eric. Right. I want to bring you into this. You're an attorney now. Your family, you and your family, have ties to the Bay Area that go back a long way.
Oh, yeah.
You and your family were there during everything that we just heard about, you know, the 1960s and the 1970s.
I was 2 to 3 years old living on Cole Street right near the Panhandle in San Francisco during the Summer of Love.
And your parents were very much involved in everything that was going on, is that
yes.
right?
Yeah, they were politically active. They were a little bit older than most of the crowd that would be considered hippies. They were a little bit before the baby boom, but they were involved in the beginning of the Peace and Freedom Party and the very beginnings of the anti-war movement, when they were naive enough to put their names, phone numbers, and addresses on the leaflets that they distributed and before the death threats and things like that. All the way back, and with ties to the Back to Land movement and everything.
You're an attorney. You could have stayed in that area. And you could have established your legal career there, charging people $500 an hour for real estate deals and then divorce. And then
I've wanted to live up this area pretty much all my life since
I
was a kid.
Here?
Well, when I was a kid, my parents did want to buy. They thought about being part of the Back to the Land. They never quite pulled it together, but they bought a piece of property outside Willits, out Sherwood Road, and we built a cabin. My dad was a carpenter. My uncle, they split the property, and they built stuff out of salvage from their spec building that they did in the Bay Area.
So you lived the Back to the Land?
Only as for vacations every weekends and
enough
summers.
Enough to be aware, though.
Enough to be aware of it, and the people around us were homesteaders, a mix of what you would call redneck and hippie people. You know, to our east on that road was a hippie family had been there for a few years. To our immediate south was a car farm of people who had been there for quite a while, a few generations. Mm-hmm. And I was familiar with it, and I loved getting there. It was my release in high school, college, law school. I wanted to be up here, and when I graduated from law school, I threw in a number of resumes out. Les Scher, who a lot of people are familiar with, is familiar with bringing jazz people to the area. Apparently, he got about 100 resumes, and his favorite musician was Rahsaan Roland Kirk. I got the interview because of my last name. Almost lost it when I didn't know who Rahsaan Roland Kirk was.
But it turned out okay.
It worked out great.
All right, guys. Nick, I want to go to the report that you've written, the background report, the history of all this whole movement that got us to where we are right now. And Eric, put your legal hat on, and you can weigh in on this as well. So what we've heard so far is that there were a lot of kids in San Francisco. Things got a little sideways there. People started moving north. A lot of them ended up in this area, Humboldt, Mendocino, Trinity, kind of all over this particular area. At the same time, at around 1970, the Controlled Substance Act classified marijuana as Schedule I with, as we know, heroin and LSD and cocaine and meth and a whole lot of other things. At about that same time, U.S. and Mexico were starting to spray paraquat, which is a toxin, on the pot fields in Mexico. That was going on. Because of the paraquat, some folks in this area said, well, we don't want that. Maybe we should have a couple of plants or something. So they did. And got kind of good at it. And at some point, they figured out even how to get the seeds out, creating Sensimilla. So all of these things come together in roughly the same period of time. Is that right? Do I have that right? And so that creates, maybe inadvertently from the government standpoint, a market for Humboldt County pot.
Absolutely.
Is that right or wrong?
Yeah. It's about... dead on right. They, as those set of circumstances come to be, the counterculture folks who are trying to make a living off the land are also realizing that, hey, you know, Humboldt County might not be the best place to be a farmer. You get a lot of competition from the Bay Area. From my perspective, at least, what I call the counterculture era realized that marijuana could be used to make a living. And then we start seeing smaller scale folks basically commercializing cannabis.
Mm-hmm. And figuring out that, hey, we can either supplement what we're doing, or maybe at some point, maybe this was a gradual thing ramping up over time. Maybe we can make just a huge living on this.
Absolutely. And then we come into the 80s.
Yeah, the term homegrown. The term homegrown was the marketing in the 70s because of the paraquat,
right.
Because of a number of items. People, you know, everybody was selling Colombia. Nobody admitted to it being Mexican. Mm-hmm. The people who moved up here, and they moved up here for various reasons. Mm-hmm. Some of them encountered Gentry Anders, who is a local historian, writes about having come up here because of violence in the East Bay involving, you know, anti-demonstration violence involving helicopters, right. and the rest. She talked about the fact that that a lot of the people who came up were grad students. A lot of people were very well educated. So at some point, somebody, probably some botany major somewhere, and we hear different stories about who did it first, learned that if you separate the male and female plants, that the female plant, sort of a sexually frustrated plant, becomes very powerful, and the potency went up, you know, overnight. At the same time, in the 1980s, you had the federally funded eradication projects that came in. Yeah. The risk became higher, the price got higher, and a lot of people talk about how the community changed, how mm-hmm. gates went up, mm-hmm. A lot of paranoia towards, you know, the sort of maybe diluting, if not defeating, the sort of peace and love sentiments that brought them here, and a lot of people also attribute satellite television to that. People had relied on each other to go and play music, and the rest, all of a sudden, when they had satellite television, it was like getting back to the suburbs. They could watch their television programs.
From only now they are.
Yeah, wherever they are. And now they have like 200 stations instead of
Eric, let me ask you one other thing. You mentioned Willits and that mm-hmm. whole area, and yes. I want to bring you in on this too, Nick, in a second. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about in the 70s and so, that decade. How long did it take for those kids who moved up here to gain enough numbers and become enough integrated into society to start having an impact on local culture, local ordinances, and so on, politically?
Well, you mentioned there was backlashes, and there were actually violent incidents. There were bars you could not walk into without getting into a fight if you had long hair and looked the wrong way. But that did change over time. The high schools did these West Side Story versions, you know, uh-huh. tailored towards it, and tried to do a lot, and the impact was enormous. I mean, the impact on San Francisco is enormous. They mentioned 100,000 kids. Population of San Francisco at that time was maybe 400,000 or 500,000.
Yeah.
So the impact coming up here,
huge.
I spoke to Ernie Branscombe, who is a prominent businessman in Garberville, and at one time, and I said, you know, that must have been quite a culture shock. And he said, you have no idea. I mean, he just, and he's friendly. He was one of the people who was first friendly to everybody, but he just said all this, their world was turned upside down. I mean, they saw it as an invasion.
Well, it was overwhelming for the city. It was even hard just to keep Haight-Ashbury clean.
Yeah.
I mean, it was difficult. And, Nick, mm-hmm. that gets me to something with your anthropology, archaeology background. Mm-hmm. Assimilation. When populations and cultures come into contact, I guess you could use the word clash, mm-hmm. Like that. What is that like, and how does it usually turn out? And how did we deal with that?
Yeah, we look at that, particularly in my case, like from the Europeans coming into Native American lands.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, and then you look at the Italian populations coming in, you look at the Irish, yeah, right. et cetera. What ends up happening is you get the population that's moving in creates a microeconomy. They start serving themselves. We can call it a commune if you want. Uh-huh. So they're buying and selling amongst themselves. And then after a period of time, you have an Italian restaurant, right?
Right.
That's serving the broader public.
People hear that it's good,
yeah,
too.
The Irish food comes into play. Guinness beer comes into play.
Corned beef and cabbage.
So, corned beef and cabbage. Parts of their culture start entering into the extant culture.
So it's the assimilation is slow and gradual.
Yes, usually.
But like Eric says, before they get to a certain point, there's some head knocking going on there.
You betcha. Look at the Europeans coming into Native America.
And Eric, was that what you remember from that period of time?
I was still in the Bay Area living as a kid. I was actually kind of a hippie kid living on the coast side of San Mateo County, Montara and Moss Beach. And yes, I had a hard time avoiding fights through the 4th, 5th, and 6th grade. They started to leave me alone around the 8th grade. But
did your parents ever think about leaving?
Yes.
They did?
They did. In fact, we did leave when my brother started repeating certain things, such as the N-word, and the rest of my parents. My mother said, we got to get them out of here. Now, that place is gentrified. It's no longer the working class kind of ghetto that it was when I was a kid. And it wasn't that poor, but it was where people lived because they couldn't afford to live close to the city. It was very similar type of thing. And so I talked to people up here, and there were very similar experiences with that. Eventually, things changed. Of course, the Half Moon Bay Coast was gentrified, but I live here because it reminds me of what Half Moon Bay was at the time.
Was then. Yeah, go ahead.
It's just absolutely fascinating. I grew up in Barron Park, just outside of Palo Alto, visiting a ranch in La Honda. Actually born in La Honda, Sky Londa. My mom worked at Alice's Restaurant, the famous Alice's Restaurant, and the one driveway I wasn't allowed to go down was Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters.
Yes.
Oh, the stories you would have now had you been allowed to go to, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Nick and Eric are staying with us, and coming up next, we're going to add your phone calls and your emails. You can reach us at 707-786-5946 or send us an email to studio@941lounge.com, studio@941lounge.com. First, though, a cultivator minute from Seth Geddes at the Beneficial Living Center. Some tips on what to be doing now and what to be preparing for next. We're back in a minute.
This time of year, we're going into the dormancy cycle. There's not a lot of plant growth happening, but the soil is still alive. There's a lot of activity going on there. There are some ways to plan ahead and get a jump on next year. It's actually not very commonly done around here, but amending certain things, this is the time of year to do it. If you need to pH adjust your soil, that takes a little longer. So now's a good time to do that. Adding lime, calcium carbonate to bring the pH up. If your soil is acidic, or elemental sulfur to bring the pH down. Your trace minerals like azomite or glacial rock dust, those types of things are great additives this time of year because those rock dusts are a lot slower. You need the microbial activity to kind of take some time to break it down and make it available. Phosphorus is actually a good thing to amend this time of year. Really slow form of phosphorus and like bone meal or soft rock phosphate. Definitely no nitrogen this time of year. Nitrogen is a very mobile nutrient in the soil. It'll all wash out. Getting a jump on your slow release minerals now. You won't need to wait so long next year. When you amend your soil, you can add a smaller amount of nitrogen and then just plant and go and maybe add a little more nitrogen as a top dress to carry it through. My name is Seth Geddes. I'm the owner of the Beneficial Living Center and Garden Supplies in Arcata. I specialize in soil amending strategies and economic gardening inputs. If you have any questions, please feel free to stop by or give a call, and we're very happy to help.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Here in the studio with us, archaeologist Nick Angeloff and attorney Eric Kirk. We want to bring you into the discussion. If you have a comment or a question, you can reach us at 707-786-5946, 786-5946, or you can send us an email, studio@941lounge.com, studio@941lounge.com. Eric, I want to pick up on something you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Cultivation, Mendocino, Humboldt, Trinity, this whole area. continued to increase through the 1970s. And as we know, by sometime in the 1980s, I don't have the exact date, we had things like minimum sentencing that kicked in, and a lot of other things. And the war on marijuana is on. This is during the Reagan years.
Yes.
And it continued. That's a risk to those home growers that started growing, as we said in the segment before, as a reaction to the paraquat and things that, that were being sprayed in Mexico. So now there's a risk to home growers.
That's right. And there's and it's almost, it becomes kind towards the end of the 80s, kind of a military operation. They show up in fatigues. There's actually a bumper sticker that's a play on U.S. out of El Salvador, U.S. out of Humboldt County because of it. And there were a number of incidents that happened in the helicopters.
The Hueys.
And the rest. And, in fact, my mother went to the Netherlands, to Amsterdam, to one of their shops where you can go buy seeds and things like that. And they had a whole setup. They have a whole romantic notion of the Northern California grower of the mannequin set up with helicopters and camouflage net and everything in the... inside in this display, and there's a little bit of truth to it. There were a lot of people communications broke up. I'm sorry if you had something there.
No, go ahead.
All right. Anyways, it did become kind of intense throughout the late 80s, kind of peaked in the mid 90s before, there was a lot of public backlash against it. I think they stopped, there was one incident where a number of them in camouflage fatigues went into the Benbow and Inn, which is a restaurant, and started talking about how we ought to just burn this whole place to the ground. Led to a lot of complaints and a lot of negative PR, and eventually kind of tapered down, and I think they kind of realized that also the way they were doing it, flying helicopters over grids, isn't necessarily the most efficient way. I mean, I think if you really wanted to bust people, people were really kind of fast and loose about things at times. You could go into a bar and see who pays in hundreds and follow them home, right? That's a lot cheaper than paying for helicopters flying back and forth. But there was block grant funding, huge money in it, and the counties all wanted that in what we call the Emerald Triangle.
And that's politically expedient for a certain group to keep this going and to get headlines with it.
And in the 80s, it was popular. Yeah. It was popular. We had these drug problems. A lot of the this was post-60s, and a lot of kids were having trouble with drugs. So, they chose marijuana as, you mentioned all of the drugs that are in
Schedule 1.
Cocaine's not, by the way. Medical cocaine has been around. They have medical cocaine, but not medical marijuana. Now there are a lot of people that don't want to have it taken out of Schedule 1 because it could mess up all of the pot statutes, medical pot statutes around the country. But so things have become really intricate. But, of course, as you'll probably get to discussing, as there was less and less of a push to suppress marijuana and it became more and more legal, the risk went down and the prices have gone down. But there was a point where in the 1980s, and I know this, that some people for really good stuff, either indoor, early indoor, or really good stuff, could get as much as $5,000 a pound wholesale for it. Now, $5,000 in 1980 is a lot more than $5,000 now. Exactly. So you're talking about a major drop over the years. I think they're talking about how it sells for maybe one, if you're lucky, $2,000 a pound now because of the glut, because of all of that. But at the time, it was a risky venture, and they could justify high prices, and it was so much better than it had ever been. The potency, I think, went up, five times what it had been?
We've got an email here from Jack in Pine Hill, and for both of you, Nick, you can weigh in on this as well. Mm-hmm. What are the biggest concerns that you're hearing from area farmers as we move toward legalization, and what are they afraid might happen?
Yeah, my background also includes being in economic development. So the biggest concerns I'm hearing is the price is dropping.
Yeah.
Just like you're saying. The black market now has a glut on it. Everybody decided this year throughout the state that one, going to have a problem with growing. They weren't going to get busted, and the price is dropping. The legal market in 2018, I think, will have a shortage for the first few years, at least two. The legal market, because there's track and trace.
So as we transition, there could be still a market for those outside
yes.
the legal market.
Absolutely, and there will be.
Eventually, those trend lines are going to cross, though.
Right? It will. But I think there'll be a glut. I think the price on the black market is going to go down. One of the main concerns that I'm hearing is that there's going to be a drive towards when you're in the black market, and that's your livelihood, you have to have the option. If you can't make the money off of that anymore, what are you going to make money off of? And that is the major concern out there. With the legal market, I think that there's going to be a glory period for a couple of years here lines cross.
Yeah, you know? You and I have talked about this before, not on this show, but at the end of Prohibition in North Carolina, yep. Southwest Virginia, and so on, yep. there was a three-year gold rush for the yep. moonshiners because for the first time, they were cheaper. Because yep. of all the taxes on legal liquor at that time. So yep. they had about this three-year window where they were cheaper. Instead of running from the county sheriff at that time, they were then yep. running from the tax man. And, of course, all of that yep. changed eventually. Got another question here. Let's see. Do you think the recent fires will reduce supply and affect prices? Good question.
I don't know. It's reducing supply of wine. I know that
yes.
In there, but I don't know how many pot farms have gone. I think you've got just such a big, huge amount. You'd have to burn an awful lot of mm-hmm. territory to put a significant dent in that. I mean, I think the estimates are we've grown something like seven times what could be consumed in California, and something like 80 to 90% of the marijuana actually has to be taken out of state, which of course increased some risk, and that
sure.
drives up the price a little bit, and that's why they go to the other states. But it's they used to refer to the Anderson Valley Advertiser used to refer to CAMP, the marijuana eradication problem, as the marijuana price support system.
Absolutely.
You know, it used to be
yep.
that way because they not only upped the price, but they did when they had their significant bus reduced, because part of the funding was based on the weight that they brought in. Of course, they'd weigh the roots and stems
yeah.
and everything, but
it's
hard for me to imagine that there's that big of a volume that's lost. Maybe have a little bit of an impact, but I don't know how much of it was going on outside Santa Rosa, probably some in the Mendocino things, but it's huge. It's
Nick, I want to go back to your report, mm-hmm. back to the 1970s, and as this was all getting ramped up, you know, as folks yep. came up here and they figured out how to grow, and Sensimilla came about and so on. In your report, you mentioned that by the end of the 1970s, so right around 1980 or so,
yep.
35% of marijuana consumed in California was homegrown by that time.
Yep.
That's not that much time before that happened.
Exactly.
I mean, people yep. hadn't been here that long,
yep.
and already 35% of it consumed in the state of California?
Yep.
Homegrown.
And that's where I'm seeing the commercialization.
Right.
Marijuana. You're starting. It's not quite industrialized yet, but
that's
it's becoming
start,
commercial.
Though,
yeah, exactly. But it's also a lot of work. At that point, the prices are down. Before CAMP, the prices are down. You're having to grow large fields of marijuana in order to make a living off of it. Once CAMP comes in, now the market has grown. You've created this, as you say, a homegrown market. Mm-hmm. CAMP comes in and limits supply, and some of the old-time growers I talked to said they just said, thank you, CAMP.
Yeah.
I have to do about a tenth of the work, and I get about five times the price.
Right. A lot of it's moving indoor.
Yep.
Right. It moves
Absolutely.
Indoor, and people could make a decent living in their garages if they did it right.
Yep.
Indoor, of course, had a lot of risk to it. One plant has pollen, one male plant, sometimes even part of a plant could be male, and the rest of it female. So you had to check every branch, and if you messed up, the fans that circulate
yep.
the air in there would seed the whole crop, and all of a sudden you just had to scrap it and start
Gee,
over.
What happened? Yeah.
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 It was,
we have a problem here. Yeah.
So there was a lot of that. But indoor started to become a thing because you could also, people started to realize, well, if I'm going to do it indoor, why am I going to do it up here in the war zone? Yeah. I could do it in Walnut Creek or, you know, somewhere else where they're not looking for
exactly.
it.
Exactly. We have a question from Shelley in Arcata for Nick. How often do you find artifacts from First Nations people?
Oh, all the time.
Really?
Humboldt County is a little more difficult than the rest of the desert counties, if you will. You can see everything on the ground in the desert. You have to really work at it to find it in Humboldt County. Artifacts, individual artifacts are common. Almost every project I go on, there might be 2 in 10 that I don't find something.
Really?
Now, an archaeological site, a whole different story.
It would be different.
We call those isolates for the most part. We'll find an arrowhead, we'll find a handstone, something to that effect. But an archaeological site is much more rare, maybe 1 in 10.
Here's a follow-up to that. When you are out there looking around, how difficult is it for you to find enough information to prove that a piece of land had a grow on it at some point? And what are you looking for?
Oh, it wasn't that difficult in the end. You start looking for post-historic era, so the cabin remnants.
Which means what?
1950s, 1960s. Okay. You start looking at that assemblage of artifacts, plumbing. Early on, they were using galvanized pipe. They were just running pipes out there.
That puts somebody on the land, but how do you know what they're doing?
Exactly. And so you start looking around. One of the earliest sites I found on that ranch was galvanized pipe with a spigot. But the small trees had been cut down, and there was metal buckets that people were growing in. So you'd see a row of metal buckets. Uh-huh. You see about, I don't know, 3-inch diameter trees that had been chopped down, but they were still sort of in the shade a little bit. What else was there? There was an old stove part. There was clearly an old little cabin there, but that was it. Later on, you start seeing the black pipe, and it becomes very easy. You start seeing the 55-gallon drums. You start seeing generators in barns, wiring that's got outlets on the ceiling. That sort of stuff starts showing up in the late 70s, early 80s. Actually got some newspapers from, I think it was 1991, in an old indoor grow out in the middle of nowhere. Generator still there. Light sockets on the ceilings. So it's
from
pretty
the early
obvious
90s.
From the early 90s. So as we move forward, we start seeing more efficient ways of growing as well. So.
Attorneys get involved in this starting in the 80s easily.
Yes.
Before that, but after camp is underway and after you know, a lot of the things in the 80s start going on, attorneys get interested in this. But are they taking a risk with career-wise? How does that work out in the 1980s?
You're entitled to take money without questioning where it came from. You could take up to $10,000 in cash without having to report it to the IRS. But it's considered privileged on that. So attorneys sometimes took it. A lot of attorneys probably said, look, you got to give me a check. You know, some of them did. Others didn't. You know, there are certain risks. There are actually risks now, more risks now, because attorneys are getting involved in helping to set up these legal projects. But while they're legal in the state, they're not legal federally, and the banks are governed by federal laws. And I'm hearing about attorneys who've had their trust account shut down because the banks don't want to be accused of laundering money through the attorney if the attorneys are taking money that's going to be used for seed projects and the rest. So there are issues now, but back then, no, they couldn't. The law shut it down right away when authorities started doing that. The courts pretty much said, no, you got to leave the attorneys alone.
Well, Nick, we're kind of in an era similar to that right now, in that we have a lot of changes in California law coming up January 1st, not federally. Although there is talk of that in Washington. Senator Cory Booker has some things underway, but nothing
federally. Barney Frank actually has had a bill that's been in committee forever that just basically says if you follow the laws of your state, there will be no federal enforcement. And that's that may actually prove popular with some of the conservatives who believe in the 10th Amendment and states' rights, you know, when it's in
But there. What about Jeff Sessions?
Sessions talks like he wants to renew the Reagan drug war.
That's where I'm getting at. that. So what do people here in California do leading up to January 1st? What do they do?
Boy, yeah, it's a tough question. You rely on California law to protect you. You're operating legally under California law. Mm-hmm. If the federal government has an issue, then it has to be with the state.
Not the individual.
Yeah, they're. I don't see how they get away with that.
Let's ask
that's
the
an
lawyer.
Attorney's question.
Well, this is really interesting because the federal government was threatening localities for a long time, and people in state government were not implementing Prop 215 stuff because they were afraid, they were intimidated by these letters that would come. And the Northern California Attorney General was actually, they weren't going after the rogue medical marijuana; they were going after the exemplary ones. The ones who were falling because they wanted to shut it down for a long time. She got moved, transferred out. But it, but then larger jurisdictions started challenging them. Santa Cruz just said, you know what, bring it on. They just said, we're going to implement that. You want to come and put the entire Santa Cruz City Council in jail, you do that. And their bluff, they won the bluff, and then other jurisdictions started doing it. And then I think we've had, 30 states that have passed medical marijuana, to at least two or three that have passed legal recreational marijuana. So the writing's on the wall. The big thing is there are people that don't want to take it out of Section 1 because then it becomes medicine, and that's regulated by the FDA, and then you've got to come up, the medical establishment has to come up with, it has to be by prescription, not just a note from your, physical therapist or something, but prescription that, and then they've got to come up with guidelines for dosages and all of that, and that's going to be really crazy because they haven't done the research.
Well, let me ask you this, and I know sometimes lawyers don't like hypothetical questions.
Oh, I love hypothetical
questions. But hypothetically, Eric, a client comes to you and they're planning on January the 1st, they're going full bore. Knowing what you know about the federal government and Mr. Sessions and Mr. Trump and so on, what do you advise that person?
You know, I don't try to convince them one way or another, but I do let them know that it may not be politically feasible, and it probably won't be, but he's talking that way, and we've got an administration that doesn't always care about what the mainstream considers as politically feasible. Sessions is saying that he wants to revive the drug war and does not want to acknowledge these laws. He's got a chip on his shoulder about it. So I say, it probably won't happen, but I couldn't guarantee it.
So, Nick, you're helping some of these folks with permitting and trying to walk them through all this. What are you telling people leading up to January 1st?
Pretty much the same thing, except for I don't believe that they can. The federal government can come in at the individual level and start. It's going to take several years if the federal government makes a war on drugs, particularly cannabis, in a state where it's been legalized. So these first few years are going to be good, and I think the individual can monitor what's going on and make that call themselves as they move forward. I also I'm on the Riedel Planning Commission, et cetera, and what we've done is we've looked at the medical marijuana market more closely. Because we haven't approved recreational in town. We're looking at companies in, we've isolated the industry to the Eel River Sawmills property. And we've left it at medical. Now, what we're trying to do is bring in medical research because I see it, and the council as well, but I see that there's a relative dearth of information that's valid, and the research needs to be done. So what we're trying to do is bring forward people who want to do that research.
And do it here.
Yes. Now, they have to make it economically viable, too, but I think Humboldt County has the genetics, has the diversity. We have an area that's uniquely positioned to study the effects of medical marijuana on a broad base of patients.
And what kind of interest are you seeing, not only from people who may want to do that, but also in Rio Dell?
Yeah, we're seeing good interest in Rio Dell. I think we have a relatively conservative council, and I think everybody's on board with medical marijuana research.
On a conservative council?
Yes, absolutely.
They're seeing it from a business standpoint.
They're seeing it from a medical research standpoint. That plays into an economic standpoint as well. I think in the long run, there's a buffer there. I think
what is that?
I think medical marijuana is safer with the federal government because of the 30 states that have legalized it than recreational is because of the five or 10. That,
right.
Yeah. In the end, we've been attracting folks from Washington D.C. who have client bases of 600 kids and been working with Johns Hopkins University. Now, with the threat of federal funding being removed in other programs, Johns Hopkins has had to walk away from the program. I'm saying that we're here. We're ready to facilitate this. These poor kids, it's been working for them. No one knows why, but it has been working, and Charlotte's Web does well in many areas. Many areas of medical issues. We can look at the strains, the levels of THC versus CBD, THCA. I don't know all the varieties there, but I think that's where we need to focus in Rio Dell, and we shelter our economy a little bit.
I think we've got a call on the phone. Sam in Bayside. Sam, you're on the air with the Humboldt Chronicles. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Really interesting show. It's
Thank you.
It's nice to hear somebody actually talking about this. I have a friend who... His business is helping people, helping area farmers get compliant, and we were having a beer the other day, and he told me that by some estimates, it's only about 20% of people in Humboldt County are actually trying to go the legit route. And I guess my question is for the attorney. What would you tell that 80% why they should consider going legit, especially as you guys were talking earlier about the prices being driven down.
Right. Eric?
Well, my legal advice is, hey, it's legal in California. It's not legal in federally. So be wary of it. But as to why they should from a legal point of view, I mean, if you're going to go long term, you've got to start looking at the business. And there is going to probably be at some point a viable legal market, which means that the black market is going to become less and less prominent. But this is the problem is that the 80%, these are people who've lived outside the system.
Yeah.
They're not people who deal with payroll and workers' compensation insurance and whatever the health department's going to require in inspections. It's a whole new world.
Doesn't that create opportunities for bookkeepers?
It does.
Medical records people?
There's already books being written. There's lawyers. The lawyers who used to do mostly criminal defense of it have switched over to helping set up the stuff. Yeah, I mean, there are quite they are sort of moving into that area because there isn't as much money in defense of bus anymore because there aren't as many bus. There still are some bus, and they're spectacular when we see them because of the numbers,
right.
Sheer numbers. But so what would I say as to why? I mean, I just say you're looking at the future. The future is probably legal, which means that there'll always be a black market, just like there's a black market on tobacco and a black market on honey and a black market on all kinds of stuff that you grow. But it's just people are going to want to buy it. They're going to want to go to the store and buy it.
Easily. Cheaply.
Right.
So the handwriting is from history. We know, especially with Prohibition, how that happens, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So as we see with Prohibition, we see the legalization come through. And like you said, there's a spike in the market, in the black market. I think we're in that now.
Temporarily.
Mm-hmm. But then I think the legal markets, those people who were making moonshine that turned mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. making legal alcohol are the ones who grew and survived.
They got good at it as moonshiners.
Yeah. Yep.
And you some betcha. Of them, some of them went into
race
real
car driving.
Business,
yeah.
And some of them went to NASCAR. Yeah, you're right. I want to thank Nick Angeloff and Eric Kirk for being guests tonight. Thank you guys so much. This was a terrific discussion. Thank you for inviting us.
Thanks for getting here.
And I want to thank you also to the folks who called in and the folks who sent in emails for us. Thank you so much for listening too. Larry, did you learn anything?
I learned, well, just a few seconds ago, I learned there was a black market for honey, so I was surprised to hear that. But I think the thing that stuck out for me was the, if not coincidence, at least not a direct relationship between the factors that created the market. The fact that the paraquat spraying happened at roughly the same time that people learned how to get rid of the seeds and increase the potency, and those two things went a long way to create the market, and they weren't necessarily hand in hand. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, coincidental, but boy, how powerful that coincidence was, huh?
Yep, absolutely.
As we can see. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. This edition of Humboldt Chronicles will be posted at 941lounge.com tomorrow for listening or downloading, and we'll be with you on the Humboldt Chronicles at 6 p.m. on the third Wednesday of each month. And the next one will be Wednesday, November the 15th, right here at 6 o'clock. See you next time. Thanks for listening.
Cool.
The Humboldt Chronicles is made possible by Patrick Finnegan, CPA, and by Archaeological Research and Supply. Some audio and information courtesy of the LBJ Library, the CBC, and the Alabama Department of Archives. For more information about the Humboldt Chronicles and to listen to any of our programs, please visit our website at 941lounge.com.
The Humboldt Chronicles is a production of Lost Coast Communications, Inc.